Good morning. May it please the court, the hearing officer and the district court below erred in two significant respects. And if this court does not right that wrong, then 13-year-old Beth's chance to learn in a language-rich and stimulating environment in her middle school will be forever lost. This is a case about the mainstreaming requirements of IDEA. Congress mandated that children with disabilities be educated with their non-disabled peers to the maximum extent appropriate. Here, in this case, Beth was educated with her peers at Lake Bluff Middle School from kindergarten to second grade when the school district determined that she should be placed in a segregated ELS classroom that was located in another school district to which she would have to be bused. After the district made this decision, Beth and her parents commenced a due process hearing, as is their right under IDEA. Beth has Rett syndrome. This is a neurological disorder that's caused by a defective gene. Importantly for the court, I'd like you to note that both the hearing officer and the district court acknowledged that there is no agreed upon consensus about what is the best way to educate a child with Rett syndrome. The hearing officer found that Beth is interested in people, that she smiles and laughs, that she responds positively to music, and that, like most kids, she has definite likes and dislikes which she can express. But she is nonverbal, and she uses a wheelchair. She can walk with assistance, but she primarily uses her wheelchair. Because Beth is nonverbal, she must rely on other forms of communication to communicate with the world. Now, these include eye gaze, her looking at things and objects or looking at the eyes of other people, her body movements, her nonverbal vocalizations, when she reaches out, or her facial expressions, such as when she raises an eyebrow to indicate that she thinks positively about something. That's quite a challenge for a little girl, and unlike us, she must rely entirely on other people to be able to read her communication, and she needs to teach them to learn to read her. Beth needs exposure to regular school because it is a language-rich environment, and that's where she will learn, and she will teach her peers how to communicate with her. Now, there are two errors that this appeal is based on. The first is the error that came from the administrative hearing when the hearing officer failed to apply the correct legal standard and he failed to properly apply the burden of proof to the school district. Beth is entitled to stay in Lake Bluff School District unless the district establishes by a preponderance of the evidence that she received no educational benefit there. The Supreme Court said as much in Raleigh when it determined that a free and appropriate education means that some educational benefit must be conferred. It doesn't mean that the best educational opportunity be conferred or that the school district takes steps to maximize the child's educational potential.
So you would suggest, Ms. Marshall, there's no balancing involved?
Your Honor, I submit that it's not required to balance and that when you do balance, you end up with anomalous results that completely read out of the IDEA statute the statutory presumption that this court found was there in the LaGrange case. In LaGrange, of course, this court considered the LRE requirement and characterized it as a strong preference of Congress and a statutory presumption. And we submit that if you balance in the way that the district court has done, you essentially eliminate that presumption entirely. And when you relieve the district from its burden of proof at the hearing level, the hearing administrative level, then the rights of a child to be educated in the mainstream environment are denied under IDEA. The district here does not dispute that it had the burden of proof at the administrative level. We submit that if you read Rowley together with its requirement that a FAPE requires some educational benefit to be conferred, with this court's decision in LaGrange that there is a statutory presumption in favor of mainstreaming the child, and you apply the proper burden of proof, which is undisputed, that the district had the burden at the administrative level, then you must conclude that the district did not carry this burden on the basis of the record which is before the court. Instead of applying the proper legal standards, what the hearing officer did was he created a different legal standard that he applied, and he made findings of fact in comparison to that different legal standard, which do not bear to the proper legal standard, and therefore which are not meaningful findings in any event for this court to pass on. He determined, for example, not whether the district had carried its burden of proof to show that Beth didn't receive some educational benefit in Lake Bluff School District, but whether the district made a careful and competent analysis that included reasonable efforts to obtain relevant information. Well, this is much like a reviewing court looking at the district court decision below, and rather than reviewing the findings of fact for clear error or looking at the legal determinations that are made, asking instead, did the district court avail itself of the resources that it had to make a proper decision? Did it carefully consider the decision? Did it use law clerks to conduct research? Did it have availability to the most current research? Those findings are irrelevant under IDEA because IDEA contains a statutory presumption that a child should be educated in the regular school environment whenever some educational benefit is conferred.
Could I ask Ms. Marshall, again, trying to interpret, among other things, what's appropriate. If in the course of, and put Beth's case aside for a second, I just want to talk to the legal principle here. If in a hearing the board establishes or acknowledges some benefit, but gives it a weight, a lesser weight in their view than what they view would be more benefit. In other words, they cannot exclude, perhaps through socialization or whatever, that there is clearly some benefit connected with mainstreaming. Could you ever overcome the presumption then, as you would have it, as I understand it at least, as long as arguably, and I don't want to quantify because I don't know how one would do that, that there's some, even if it appeared to be quantitatively lesser in the view of the board, that they could never overcome, could they ever overcome the presumption?
Well, certainly they could, and this court has found as much, I think, in several decisions that it has passed on, in Heather S. and Murfreesboro, in terms of the analysis that the court applied there. Our position is not that children always should be mainstreamed. Our position is that children with disabilities belong to be in the regular school environment unless the district can come forward and establish that they're not receiving some educational benefit.
That's clearly congressional intent, I think. That's
well, and so I think Your Honor raises what I would agree is the difficult question under the statute, and that is, what is some educational benefit? I think that that is a highly individualized inquiry, and the reason why the multi-factor tests don't work, because the multi-factor tests attempt to shoehorn or pigeonhole the very complex and varied disabilities that children have into a number of factors. Moreover, the multi-factor test, for example, the one cited in Daniel R.R., goes too far because it leads into the statute things that are not there. Requirements, for example, that a child's curriculum in the regular education needs to be closely aligned with the general curriculum, or that you would measure the child's progress in comparison to the skills that are being achieved by the child's peers. Those requirements are nowhere in IDEA. So I would submit, Your Honor, that the proper analysis is to have this be a question of fact that at first is considered at the administrative level, and then when findings are made on those facts, is reviewed at the district court level, was some educational benefit conferred in the regular school environment? And the parties, of course, would be submitting witnesses and experts on those facts, and those findings would then be made and would be subject to review. What we have here is an absence of any finding by the hearing officer that the district carried its burden to show that Beth did not receive some educational benefit. In fact, the hearing officer said over and over again that he could not find that, in fact, the district had established that its methodology was superior. And that's why he fell back on the only standard which he felt he could apply, but we say is erroneous, and that is that he looked at the methodology by which the district reached its decision. When this went to the district court and it was reviewed there, the second error is that this appeal is rooted in the district court's treatment of the case. Now, here the district court compounded the error because it applied the incorrect legal standards. The district court asked how he could balance a free and appropriate education with the least restrictive environment requirement because he perceived that these two requirements were in conflict or competed with one another as values. But they can be reconciled and there's no conflict here. Educating a child in the least restrictive environment is a necessary but not sufficient condition to providing a free and appropriate education. This means that you will start the analysis of, in this case with Beth. Was her placement in this regular school one which conferred some educational benefit? And if the answer to that question is yes, then the inquiry stops. I think the district court made the error because he separated those two and did not give the statutory presumption to the LRE requirement that this court found in LaGrange. The district court started with the question, does the school district's proposed placement confer some benefit? And when he analyzed it in that way, he determined that it did confer some benefit. But that's not the question that he should have asked. The initial question was, did her placement in regular school confer some benefit? And did the district carry its burden to show that it did not confer some benefit? I believe that this case is one that turns very heavily on the burden of proof and the proper application of it. Here you have two parties who very vigorously dispute the proper education for this child. But their dispute is not grounded simply in the fact that they've come to an honest disagreement about how to do it. Each of them has come forward with evidence and witnesses and presented at a 19-day administrative hearing. After reviewing all of this evidence, the hearing officer concluded that he could not determine that the school district had carried its burden of proof to show that this child did not receive any educational benefit or some educational benefit at her regular school placement. And as a result, the district court should have given due weight to those factual findings. But instead of doing that, the district court went beyond and accepted the hearing officer's methodology that he only had to look to see whether the district was being reasonable. And from there, he built his opinion and tried to correct the error that there had been no express analysis of the LRE requirement by going into the multi-factor test. Well, once you are into the multi-factor test, you, of course, are establishing requirements that are not present in the IDEA. And we believe that the evidence in this case establishes not only that the child, Beth, did, in fact, establish her legal standard that would entitle her to remain in her school, and that is that the district didn't carry its burden of proof, but that she showed through the evidence that was submitted that not only does she receive some educational benefit, which is the standard required by law, but that in fact this is the best education for Beth. Now, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Right.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Is that pronounced Kriya?
Kriya, yes.
Ms. Kriya.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Darcy Kriya, and I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the defendants, Dr. Mark Van Clay, and the Lake Bluff School District. I want to talk just quickly about, since opposing counsel discussed Beth's abilities, I want to shed a little bit of light on that also. I agreed with everything counsel said. The one thing that counsel omitted was an appraisal or a discussion of Beth's cognitive abilities. Girls with Rett syndrome actually have a near cessation of brain functioning before they reach the age of 2. And so Beth is not only nonverbal, but she functions cognitively at the level of a 12 to 18-month-old infant. And that is very typical of girls with Rett syndrome. She cannot recognize letters, numbers, or colors. She cannot imitate the actions or speech of others, and she requires one-on-one assistance at all times. She does need individuals around her that can read her. I agree with my opposing counsel. One of the very primary problems with a regular ed placement is that in middle school, Beth would currently be in seventh grade. She would have seven teachers a day for 42 minutes a period. In an ELS program the district has proposed, she would have one trained special education teacher with her all day. A perfect example of a person who could read her cues and read her nonverbal communication patterns. So consistency is key in this case, and that goes to the very heart of Beth's disability. The parent has demonstrated in this case a few very basic misunderstandings of IDEA law that I would like to point out. First of all, the issue of FAPE and LRE. FAPE clearly takes precedence over LRE. This court has held as much in both Lockman and Murfreesboro. In Lockman, you held that mainstreaming can only be given effect when the placement sought by the parent provides FAPE first. FAPE is the first issue. You heard opposing counsel say the LRE has to give educational benefit separate. FAPE is the test that asks two things. One, and this was promulgated by Raleigh, United States Supreme Court case, one, did the district follow all the procedures in the act? And two, does the benefit proposed by the school district confer educational benefit on the student? That's FAPE. That stands above LRE. LRE comes second. If the court determines that, if they answer that first question, no, that there is no educational benefit conferred in the placement proposed by the school district, then they turn their attention to LRE. But in this case, both the hearing officer and Judge Moran held very clearly in their decisions, that the proposed placement made by the district provided Beth with FAPE. It would provide her with educational benefit. Parents argue, you heard, they argued in their brief and they argued here this morning, that they don't propose that all disabled students be educated in a regular ed setting, but that is in fact exactly what the parents are proposing. If Beth is educated, if she is to be educated in a regular ed setting, then all disabled students would be educated in a regular ed setting. The standard that this court would set would be much lower than it is currently. One of the other things that one of the basic misunderstandings that parents have in this case, they argued in their brief at length that judicially construed law is not applicable and that we should only look to IDEA, the statute, which is one paragraph, and we should only look to the seven regulations that talk about LRE. When we look to the section in IDEA, there are two phrases that defy explanation. The very first five words in the statute say that to the maximum extent appropriate, children with disabilities will be educated with their non-disabled peers, and that segregation or separate schooling will only occur if education in the regular ed classroom cannot be achieved satisfactorily. That's the statute. That's all that IDEA says about LRE. The phrases maximum extent appropriate and cannot be achieved satisfactorily defy simple explanation. We need courts. We need the Seventh Circuit. We need the district courts in this circuit.
That's at least a comfort to me.
Yes, yes. I knew it would be, Judge Bauer. We need you to define the standards. It is not enough to simply look at the regulation itself. On its face, it's meaningless. So that's exactly, even though counsel this morning has indicated that's not what they're arguing, that is precisely what the argument is. They've waived that argument, by the way, kind of goes without saying. I argued in the brief that this court has held recently, it was in 1996 in Johnson versus Doonland, that the failure of a party to raise an issue before the district court was in effect a waiver, that the Seventh Circuit would not consider it. They have not argued. They did not argue before the hearing officer or before Judge Moran that judicially construed law was inapplicable in this case, thus they have waived that argument. The third fundamental misunderstanding that comes through in their brief particularly is that a disabled student should have a right to be educated in their home school with their friends. In fact, the IDEA contains a preference for mainstreaming. That is agreed, but it is not a mandate. The Tenth Circuit has said that specifically. There's actually a Ninth Circuit case, Pula, that speaks very it's very on point with the case at bar. In that case, a very profoundly deaf Native American student was placed by the district in a residential school for the deaf over 200 miles from his home. And his parents argued, well, that's not right. We want him to stay living in our home. We want him to remain with the tribe. And the Ninth Circuit in Pula said, no, that in fact the benefit of staying with your tribe and with your family was actually outweighed by the need to learn to communicate. And that's what he was non-communicating. He could not communicate owing to his disability. The burden of proof in this case, another thing that bears mentioning, is that parents argued in their brief to this court that the burden of proof, no matter who was successful at the district court level, should remain on the school district. And that's incorrect. You've held in at least four cases, including Patricia P. in Murfreesboro, that the burden of proof is on the party who is challenging the administrative decision. And so I would advocate that you continue with that holding. As for standard of review, which opposing counsel brings up this morning, Judge Flom, you were just absolutely correct. The school district could never overcome the standard that parents are articulating. As I said before, if that was mainstreamed, we would have all students mainstreamed. In this case, the hearing officer, and this is in the record at A34, he held that the school district has the burden of proving by a preponderance of the evidence that it proposed an appropriate placement for the student. He nailed it. That's absolutely the correct standard. Judge Moran also got the standard correct. This is in the record. Also, his standard of review, he said, was very unique in IDEA cases. He said, legal questions, I look at de novo, Judge Moran said. He said, facts I review independently, but I give due weight to the hearing officer's decision. He said that, yes, there is a tension. There is a tension that is inherent between FAPE and LRE. He was correct. Other courts have pointed that out. There is a tension in saying that you need to provide an appropriate placement combined with that secondary issue of where that placement needs to be. Does it need to be in the home school? Does it need to be in the least restrictive environment? There is an honest tension there. As far as in their brief, also I wanted to just touch on the fact that they argued that summary judgment was not appropriate when facts, material facts, are in dispute. And we're agreed that there are material facts in dispute in this case. But this court has held that the procedural vehicle for deciding IDEA cases is summary judgment, and that it is appropriate even when material facts are in dispute. They also advocate that that they were not allowed to conduct enough discovery, both before the hearing officer and before the district court. In this case, this is very unique in that Judge Moran actually heard additional evidence. It's very rare in IDEA cases. But he decided that it would benefit him to learn how Beth was doing in sixth grade, which was the current school year at the time. And so he held essentially a three-day evidentiary hearing where four witnesses testified, two for parents and two for the school district, and he heard additional evidence. So the parents' argument that they weren't allowed an opportunity to conduct discovery or get enough information just falls flat. They did have two clear opportunities. It also is interesting to note that this due process hearing was 19 days in length, and it stands as the longest due process hearing held to date in the state of Illinois. So their argument that they didn't have time or didn't have enough opportunities to present evidence is just not correct. They also asked this court to remand it back to the district court for gathering more evidence. They failed to cite to any case in support of that proposition, and my research did not yield any case either. One of their arguments in their brief was that you should remand to Judge Moran so that we can get some evidence on their Section 504 and ADA claims. But this court actually, in Monticello, you said that that was an inappropriate use of IDEA's language. IDEA has a provision that says additional evidence shall be gathered, but that did not apply to ADA or 504 claims. And in this case, there was no proof of any intentional discrimination either before the district court or the hearing officer, and there was no gross misjudgment or bad faith. Those are the elements, of course, that are necessary to support an ADA or 504 claim. I asked you in the brief to consider adopting an LRE standard. The court to date has declined to do so. And I think globally, one of the reasons that you ought to consider doing so is essentially to give guidance to IEP teams and school districts and parents not to mention the district courts in this circuit, when they're considering LRE placement issues. You can see, for example, in the district court decisions, when you read them, when they deal with LRE, the DF case that was decided by the Southern District of Indiana, or even by Judge Moran in this case, that they struggle with finding the appropriate standard. So if this court were to articulate one, it would be most helpful, both to the district courts underneath you and to school districts who are grappling with this issue.
In your position that the majority of the circuits have adopted a standard or test?
It's interesting. There are four that are that clearly have adopted a standard. The Daniel R.R. test, which is the test I advocate, has been adopted by the 3rd, 9th, and 11th circuits. There is a second standard, the Ronker standard, or Ronker feasibility test, it's called. That's been adopted by the 6th and the 8th circuits. So, yes, there are, perhaps it's not a majority, but it is a fair number.
No, it seems to be, just slight.
Perhaps a slight majority, that's correct. Daniel R&R is preferable because it most closely resembles the language of the statute. That is one of the issues that Parents Council takes issue with. But it's Daniel R&R. In fact, when the Fifth Circuit went to articulate their test, the very first thing they did was they said, we're going to first look at the language of IDEA and its regulations in formulating our test. The other nice thing about the test is that it does not contain an exhaustive list of factors. It gives essentially four areas, both academic and non-academic. It talks about disruption to the classroom, to the child, to the teacher. It talks about the effect that the student would have. It also deals directly with the student's disability. What is the student's disability? Is she able to grasp the basic essentials of the curriculum, the basic ideas? So it's a test that actually the Fifth Circuit says very specifically, we're going to try to strike an appropriate balance between academic considerations and non-academic considerations. The Ronker test has actually not been favored. It does not follow the statute. It's a feasibility test. The Ronker statute says that you have to look at the things that make the segregated placement preferable. And if those can feasibly be provided in the regular ed setting, then you need to provide them in the regular ed setting. Daniel R&R said that they didn't like that function or that operation because it intruded too much on the decision, like an educational policy decision that educators need to make. If they think that a more segregated placement is appropriate, then there should be no need to turn it in on itself and look to see whether that could be provided in a regular ed setting. And as you can see, that has not been adopted by, it's only been adopted in the Eighth Circuit.
And the Fourth.
And actually, it was the Eighth, and then it was articulated by the Sixth. The Fourth Circuit I don't have on my list as having adopted one, but as I understand it, Ronker was a Sixth Circuit case, 1983, and the Eighth Circuit adopted it in 87 in AW.
And the Ninth Circuit, would you consider that a test?
The Ninth Circuit, yes. Actually, yes, that's a good point. The Holland test arose in the Ninth Circuit in 1994, and for a while there, it was considered a test on its own accord. But since then, it's kind of odd, in fact, in Holland, which is the Ninth Circuit, it was decided in 1994. For about a year, it was considered a test on its own merit. But then in 1995, the Ninth Circuit issued the decision in Pula, which was the case of the Native American boy, and they actually adopted the Daniel R.R. test in the Pula case. So it's almost as if the Holland test was on its feet for about a year in the Ninth Circuit, and then in 1995, the Ninth Circuit decided to kind of grab on board the Daniel R&R and subscribe to that test. So the Holland test, actually, in reading it, it mimics it. It's very similar to the Daniel.
Would you say the Holland test doesn't exist in the Ninth Circuit any longer?
That is exactly what I'm suggesting, yes. Now, the reasons that the ELS placement is appropriate, I touched on a few of them. One is, of course, consistency. Beth would have one special education teacher. All 19 classrooms, ELS classrooms, are in regular education buildings, and she will participate with regular education peers in special class units, projects, assemblies, parties, field trips, and the like. My time is up, so I would ask that the court affirm the decision of Judge Moran.
Thank you, Ms. Greer.
Thank you.
Ms. Marshall.
Several points to address those that were just made. First and most importantly, I would point out to the court that the question of Beth's cognitive disabilities is something that is quite in dispute in this case. The briefs of the party outline each of their positions on this. Moreover, the hearing officer expressly found that he could not rule or determine what was Beth's cognitive ability. This is part of the...
Is there any reason to believe that Beth can do seventh grade level work? Does she pass the test ordinarily given to sixth graders, for example?
Beth does not need to do seventh grade work. Beth needs to be able to show meaningful progress in relationship to her goals. And that's all that the statute requires.
Why would a school have to educate in an ordinary seventh grade class somebody who can't pass the exams given to sixth graders?
Because Congress said that the nation's disabled children deserve to be educated with the non-disabled.
I'm not asking a question about disability. I'm asking a question about ability. Normally one thinks that a school can hold back from progress somebody who has not completed the work of the prior grade. One of the arguments you are making is that in the IDEA, Congress has required the year-to-year advancement of every student without respect to achievement. That's quite, I think, it's a very strong claim that Congress has prevented the school district from holding back anybody who didn't complete the prior year's work.
I would submit that there's a much more narrow and rational basis, and that is the IEP process. This goes to the question, Judge Flom, that you asked with respect to, does every child have to be passed in this period? Does every child then deserve or meet some educational benefit? And that is, the IEP process is specifically designed to develop individualized goals. That's what Congress mandated. And so in determining whether some educational benefit is conferred, we submit that you would look at whether the child has shown meaningful progress toward their goals. We've cited numerous instances in our brief.
Could I just ask you a question? I know you're running out of time, but there are a few more challenging types of cases that come before this court that I'm sure counsel would agree than these. And the great challenge, of course, for me is this maximum extent appropriate. Would you say that we should look at it through the prism solely of the individual child, and also your most recent remarks, Ms. Marshall? In other words, appropriate in no other context than whether it's Beth's case or another child's case. Is that, do we cabinet that way? It's laid against no other grid?
I think in a way that you must, because if you look at the Supreme Court's recent decisions in Rowley and Garrett, the trend is very definitely toward rejecting these multi-factor tests where the courts have said that the Congress didn't provide sufficient ability for the courts
but
to
you
assess.
But you would agree that at least seemingly a majority of the circuits are attempting, although you would argue, I guess that would be in derogation of what you would think to be the trend from the most recent Supreme Court case. But it does seem the majority of the circuits have been grappling with some attempt at an analysis that speaks beyond the confines of the factors of just the individual case.
I would bring the court back to the IEP process and say that the proper analysis is to look at the mutually agreed IEP and then determine whether the child is making meaningful progress towards those goals. In this case, the IEP was established, and there are instances which we've cited to the court out of the record, and the lower court and the hearing officer did not find to the contrary that Beth was making meaningful progress towards her goals. And so by looking at that as the standard and saying that some educational benefit means that the parties must come before the hearing officer and present their evidence as to whether the child is making meaningful progress towards her goals, as agreed by the school district and the parents in the IEP process, you create a very clear standard for which findings of fact can be made and later reviewed.
Yeah, let me just conclude, obviously not precluding my brothers from asking questions. Would we have a situation then, whether it's Beth's case or another, where regardless of the placement in a particular class, we're in a mainstream setting, and annually a review process allowed for three or four qualified people to make an assessment. As long as any positive assessment from a credible source and not discounted by either a hearing officer or whatever review process, were to suggest that there's improvement certainly over the last 12 months or 6 months, that really would be sufficient in your view?
I believe meaningful progress.
I'm using meaningful, I suppose, as carefully as the Congress used appropriate, which is to say it's very difficult to...
Well, if you're showing, for example, if you have 16 goals and you're showing progress in 13 of them, and you're able to establish that the environment in which the child is one that is stimulating and helping that child learn to acquire knowledge.
I think your reference to 16, I know you just probably picked that number,
is
the same situation we're finding with the circuits reaching for 4, 3, and 7.
Well, Your Honor, I would point out as well that if you look at the penultimate statement of the test that the various circuits have cited, they're kind of hard to disagree with. I mean, both Daniel R.R., Ronker, and the Fourth Circuit, of course, has adopted the Ronker test in DeVries. But if you look at those penultimate statements in Daniel R.R., whether education in the regular classroom with supplemental aids and services can be satisfactorily achieved, well, that's right out of the statute. The problem isn't with that statement of the test. It's in the factors that are then cited beneath it. You don't have to modify the regular school curriculum. The child has to be able to grasp the essential elements of the regular school curriculum. You balance the benefits of regular ed and special ed. And our position is that those requirements are nowhere found in the statute.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Marshall. Garrett, thanks to all counsel. The case is